everyone, and welcome to Cellular Healing TV. This is episode 112, and we have Dr. Pompa here, and we have a very special guest today, Dr. Jason Fung. We're going to talk about obesity, diabetes, fasting. Dr. Fung has a lot of expertise in these areas, so before we jump into the conversation, I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. So Dr. Jason Fung earned his medical degree at the University of Toronto, where he also completed his internal medicine residency before heading to the University of California, Los Angeles for his fellowship in nephrology. He currently practices as a kidney specialist in Toronto. During the course of treating thousands of patients, it became clear to Dr. Fung that the epidemic of type 2 diabetes and obesity was getting worse. The prevailing dietary recommendations to reduce dietary fat and calories were clearly ineffective. He founded the Intensive Dietary Management Program to provide a unique treatment focus for type 2 diabetes and obesity. Rather than focusing on medications, this clinic focuses on dietary changes that are simple yet effective. In March 2016, so I know just this month, Greystone Books will publish Dr. Fung's first book, The Obesity Code, which explores the underlying hormonal imbalance that leads to obesity and recommends effective strategies that address the root cause of weight gain. So I know you and Dr. Pompa are really in alignment on a lot of different areas, so we're so excited to have you on the show. Welcome, Dr. Fung.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Dr. Fung, we are grateful that you came on the show, and our viewers are just, they're already educated about a lot of the things that you say. Not that it takes away from it by any means. It just excites me, you know, when I see a doctor who breaks out of the norm, so to speak, and, you know, ends up crossing into something that we both know is the answer to a growing epidemic of, you know, why people can't lose weight, why people have hormone challenges, diabetes, thyroid conditions. You know, these conditions are costing our country, the world, greatly financially and taking people's health, and yet we're throwing more medication at it, and we're throwing even the dietary changes that are recommended, low-fat, low-calorie diets. I love that in your bio, that you said that frustrated you, that between the medications and the low-fat, low-calorie diets wasn't the answer. So with that said, how did you go from there in the, you know, the obviously you had medical training and, you know, and that's your background to where you are now with, you know, believing what we believe.
Yeah, it's actually quite an interesting journey because it, you know, I went through medical school and I went through specialist training, and for the first, what, about 7 or 8 years of my practice, I was just treating people the same as most doctors, right? If weight loss was not something I thought about, really. I didn't deal with it much. I told them to go see somebody to exercise a little more, you know, eat a little less, look at the food guide or whatever national food recommendations. But it really was around the mid-2000s that things started to get interesting for me, because what happened, of course, was that the Atkins diet was very popular somewhere around the 2000s. So a lot of studies got launched just around that time, and they all got published somewhere around 2006 to 2008. And they started appearing in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is really the top medical journal in the world. And what was really fascinating was that these diets were doing much better than our conventional, you know, recommended diets, right? So the people who did these studies, a lot of them did them with the expectation that these Atkins dieters would do a lot worse, and here they were doing much better, not just in terms of weight loss, but in terms of their entire metabolic profile. So that was when I started to think about nutrition a lot, because here's a kind of very interesting paradox. And as I started to look deeper and deeper into this sort of thing, you realize that a lot of these kind of hand-me-down nutritional beliefs, they're really just not true. Wow. I mean, even from the very, very basics of what we know, like calories in, calories out, which is something that we're taught kind of from kindergarten almost, right? It's all about calorie balance and all this kind of stuff. It's just all wrong, which is fascinating.
Absolutely.
To me, that we could get to this point where we are just, you know, one of the biggest diseases that is affecting us the entire premise of treatment is completely incorrect. And that's just that's just unbelievable that could be the case. It's actually really interesting because if you look back, and I think that where we are comes from a kind of mistaken treatment paradigm. So we're stuck in this kind of 19th century paradigm where infectious disease was the major kind of in the 20th century, late 19th century, is all infectious disease. That's what's killing people. So we went through a period where we had these antibiotics and penicillin and great medicines, right? And so infectious disease just kind of really got treated very well. So we got into this treatment paradigm of, one disease, one drug, right? Yeah. And so we approach these diseases of the 21st century, which is obesity, type 2 diabetes, and all of its kind of attendant diseases with the same paradigm, though. Like, what drug can we give for this, right? But it's the wrong approach.
Yeah.
Because these are dietary diseases, and therefore we need to fix our diet and use dietary strategies, such as fasting that we talked about, that have been around for, like, ever, and use these strategies to attack the root cause of the problem, which is all dietary, instead of saying, oh, here's a new drug for this. But you look around, and that's all doctors talk about, right? Oh, what's the new drug for obesity, right? I'm like, that's totally the wrong approach right from the get-go, right? We don't need a surgery for obesity. We don't need drugs for obesity. We need to change the diet.
Well, and then that translates into even, diabetes and thyroid and heart disease, right? I mean, of course, there's a time and a place, for a medication. But, again, it's if you don't get to the cause, then, what are you really solving? You're not solving anything, right?
And, exactly. And that's, that's the whole point of my book, The Obesity Code, was what's really causing weight gain. Mm-hmm. I wanted to actually call the book The Etiology of Obesity. Etiology, for those who don't know, is a medical term meaning what's the cause of it. But, it was too medical, right? So they nixed that title and said, no, you can't use it. But that was really what my original title was, because I really wanted to say, what is the cause of obesity? Because if we get that question wrong, then you get everything wrong, right? And the real problem is that our understanding of what causes obesity right now is too many calories, right? It's all this calorie balance, this calorie paradigm. And it's crazy because it's, the calorie understanding has only been around for 50 or 60 or 70 years, right? 200 years ago, people didn't have bomb calorimeters. Nobody measured the calorie value of foods, and nobody had obesity, right? Yep. And it's not like people were, you look at 1930, 1940 America, people are not starving of hunger, right? Yep. It's not that there was no food. There was plenty of food. There was just no obesity, right? And that's what we really have to know. Or even go fast forward, like 1960s, like how many people are really dying of hunger in New York City, right? Almost none, right? Yeah, there's some soup kitchens and so on.
Right.
But it's not like the widespread famine that you would see in biblical Egypt or something, right? So that's not something, people talk about this whole thrifty genes and all this sort of stuff as if people are starving in 1960s United States, right? That didn't happen. Right, and yet there had no obesity. We had to find out what caused it, and I think that really we started with the wrong thing, with the calories kind of paradigm, that it's a caloric imbalance rather than a hormonal imbalance, and that's where everything kind of fell off the tracks, because now all our strategies are dealing with calories, but calories aren't the problem.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, if you look at the Diabetes Association diet, low fat, low calories, exercise more, and matter of fact, replace all your fats with margarine, man-made fats. Oh, and use artificial sweeteners. That's the diet that they're still
promoting.
So even when they do focus on, okay, let's get to the diet, okay, then they get it wrong, Doc, because this, I believe this stuff comes, it gets locked into government, and I always have a saying that once something gets into government, you almost can never back it up, right? It's like, this low-fat, low-calorie message is something that if you turn your television on this morning, I promise you they'll talk about a low-calorie, low-fat recipe of some sort. You know, every media outlet still talks about this faulted science, you know, this junk science that where did it come from? But now that it's here, here we are. You know, so yeah. You said a key point, and I want you to expand on it. You and I both believe that weight, the inability to lose weight or sudden weight gain, this is a hormone problem. You know, I always say, look, we know that we can talk about food, we can talk about diet, but more specifically, this is a hormonal problem today. You know, so talk a little bit about that. How did we get here, and what do you mean by hormone problem?
Yeah, so if you want to prove causation, what you need to do is basically give people what you think is the causative agent and see if it causes it, right? And that's what we do all the time. So when we prescribe insulin, so the major player here is insulin, when you give insulin to people, people gain weight. That's the bottom line, right? Whether you think the mechanism is that this or that, it doesn't matter. But when I prescribe insulin to people, people gain weight. When I give them drugs, yeah, such as sulfonylureas, which are diabetic medications, which also raise insulin, they gain weight. If I deal with the diabetes by prescribing something such as metformin, which is a different diabetes drug that doesn't cause that insulin surge, then they don't gain weight, right? So here you have a direct correlation. And everybody who's ever taken insulin or any family members and every doctor already knows this. You give insulin, people come back and complain about their 20, 30-pound weight gain.
But their glucose is better. That's what they think. So the doctor goes, yeah, but look, your glucose looks better. Your blood looks better. But they're going, I'm gaining weight, and I still don't have energy. I still don't feel well.
Absolutely. And that's absolutely the wrong thing to do because the patients know it already. And that's what I always find funny is that the patients always come back, and they always say things like, Doc, you've always told me that I need to lose weight to control this diabetes, yet you give me a drug and I've gained like 30 pounds. How is that good? And you say something like, oh, well, you have to because your glucose is too high or something like that. But they already know there's something going wrong here, right? They're gaining weight, which leads them to take more insulin, which is going to make them gain more weight, which is going to lead them to take more insulin. And that's what happens. That's exactly what happens. So they're in this downward spiral where they're just getting worse and worse and worse, and what we're doing is actually making it worse, and that's the real problem, right? And the thing about type 2 diabetes is that it's really a disease of insulin resistance, right? That's the actual disease. But the problem is our treatment is based on lowering the blood sugar, right? And so we're treating the symptom, and we're not treating the disease. In fact, the disease does nothing but get worse, because if you look at the typical history, natural history of what happens, people get started on medication, then they get more medication, then more, and then insulin, and then more and more. So their diabetes is not getting better with treatment. It's getting worse with treatment.
Absolutely.
So even as the blood sugars are getting better, the diabetes is getting worse. And it's like alcoholism, right? If you take a couple shots of alcohol, those shakes go away, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean your alcoholism is getting better. So we're treating the symptoms, but the disease is getting worse. And that's the real problem with the way we approach type 2 diabetes and the related problem of obesity. I mean, it's really a hormonal issue. And once you understand that, and this is what I get into in the book, is really if you look at low insulin, for example, if you take away insulin, like type 1 diabetics, their insulin levels go very low. What happens to their weight? Well, you would predict if insulin is the major causative agent that their weight should go way down, and that's exactly what happens with type 1 diabetes, right? And the type 1 diabetics actually know this. There's an entire eating disorder called diabulimia where patients will deliberately underdose their insulin. Like dangerous, like crazy, right? Their sugars go up, they might get ketoacidosis, they could kill themselves. But they do it because the weight comes way down, right? That's the whole issue. So when you give insulin, weight goes up. When you take away insulin, weight goes down. So clearly we have a causative relationship here that you don't see in calories, right? So if you think calories causes weight gain, you can give calories and see if they will gain weight on a long-term basis. And they've done these deliberate force-feeding studies where people overeat, and you gain weight for a little bit. There's a few very famous ones done in the 60s where they actually took college kids, and they said, just eat a lot of food because we want you to gain weight. So this guy, Dr. Ethan Sims, he had actually tried to do it in rats, right? So he gave a lot of food, but he couldn't force these rats to gain weight. And he thought, okay, well, can I do it with humans? And, you know, all the college students thought, oh, yeah, no problem, piece of cake, right? And what was fascinating was that those college kids just couldn't gain weight. It was incredible. You'd force them to eat, and then they would eventually just stop, and then you couldn't force them anymore. So then he went to the jail, and he got a bunch of prisoners, and he forced them to eat as part of an experiment, which is quite funny. So then he'd watch them, he'd make sure that they didn't exercise more, and he'd force them to eat. And some of these guys were eating like 10,000 calories a day. And some of them, like, their weight went up, but as soon as you stopped forcing them to eat, their weight just came right back down to its original. So that's interesting, because if you're saying that calories is what causes weight gain, but yet you give calories and it doesn't go up, then you don't have that causal relationship there. And the same works on the flip side.
That's right.
If you think that calories causes weight gain, take away calories, you should see weight loss, but you don't. And we all know this, right?
Yeah,
so studies of caloric restriction are crazy, because the failure rate is like 98%.
You know where people get trapped in to where they believe it? Because I always like to say this, because if people cut calories, there's that beginning phase where they actually lose a little weight, right? I always say women, you know, the most you could possibly lose is about 10 pounds, and then men maybe a little more when they cut their calories way down. But what happens? The complicated hormonal metabolism starts to drop as well, and then the weight starts to come back on. Or when you cut calories, you just can't do that. You can't just push food away. And I always talk about this on other shows. Eventually, you start to eat again, right? It's like, so two ways it fails. Either your body says, no, okay, we can't just, you know, cut calories, we're going to eat again. But ultimately, your metabolism goes lower and lower. So ultimately, you never lose weight. You really never lose any weight long term. But people hold on to that little short little blip when they see themselves cut calories and they see their weight drop slightly, probably water, some fat, some muscle, probably mostly muscle. But the point is, they see the scale go down, so they think it works, Doc.
Yeah, absolutely. And every single diet study has shown this sort of same thing. You see the very bottom at around 6 months, sometimes 9 months, and then it always goes up. And every dieter knows this, of course, right? At 6 months, what happens is that you start to plateau, right? And then so you double up your efforts, right? Cut calories even more, right? And for a while it works. But then, again, you plateau, and then you start feeling like crap, right? You're feeling cold, and you're feeling hungry, and you think it's all your fault, right? But the problem is exactly what you've said, and the studies are very clear on this. So when you cut your calories, your metabolism goes down. So you start with 2,000 calories in and 2,000 out. You cut it to 1,500. You lose a bit of weight. Great. But then your body just reduces it to 1,500 calories, right?
Exactly.
But now, because you're only burning 1,500 calories, you're cold, you know, your metabolism's slowing down, right? And then the other thing that they've shown is that your hunger hormones go up, your satiety hormones go down. So you're actually hungrier, not because you have no willpower, but you're actually hungrier because your hormones are telling you to gain that weight back. So you're hungrier and your metabolism has slowed down. So that's kind of a double whammy that you'll never get out of, right? So what happens, of course, is that you're at 1,500 calories in, 1,500 out. You're feeling like crap. You feel it's not worth it, right? So then you go up to 1,700, still less than you used to take, and the weight starts coming back,
right?
And then it goes right back up.
Yeah.
And now your metabolism's at 1,700. You feel like crap. Your weight goes back to what it was, and then everybody blames you for failing the diet. Right, and that's the super unfair part about weight loss, is that all these dieters get blamed when we know exactly what's happening. We know that it will happen for sure, and the weight loss, like the studies of weight loss, show that like 98% of people fail. So one, why would we ever give advice that has a 98% failure rate? And two, it's so unfair that when people fail, they get the blame instead of the advice getting the blame, right? Nobody ever says, it's because your stupid eat less, move more advice was really bad. We knew it was bad and we knew you'd fail, right? Nobody ever says that. People say, oh, you fell off your diet. Well, you know, it's bound to happen. Right? And that's the real problem. But if you understand that what the issue is really a hormonal issue, then you can say, well, now what we need to do is look for ways not to cut calories, because it's not a calorie problem. What we need to do is look for ways to lower insulin, because that's the real issue. And that's what the strategies are, and both you and I use them all the time, right? So cutting out a lot of the sugars and the refined grains and the intermittent fasting is the main strategies, but those are strategies aimed at lowering insulin, not lowering calories.
You know, Doc, when I entered 50 years old, of course, everyone in this country has the adage that, well, the older you get, the fatter you get. And I can tell you at 50, I am leaner, with lower body fat, with more energy, better brain than even when I was in my 20s. You know, how is that possible? Because I'm very, very insulin sensitive. Wait, I'm very hormone sensitive because of the things that I practice that you just said. You know, I intermittent fast every day. Now, by the way, at the end of my day, yeah, I probably eat less calories than everybody, but I promise you this, never once do I go, oh, I'm going to eat less at this meal. Quite the opposite. I make sure I eat to full every time I eat, right? Yeah. So, you know, when we look at these studies that people live longer when they eat less, we think that people in Okinawa are just simply pushing food away, you know, and eating to, you know, it doesn't work that way. You know, the innate intelligence in the body goes, you know, I'm going to lower my metabolism. I'm starving. You know, but my body knows it's not starving because I'm eating big, full meals. You know, however, I take 18 to 20 hours in between my dinner and my next meal day, you know, and that makes my cells very, very hormone sensitive and obviously insulin. So when you look at my hormone levels, they're very, very low. Yeah. However, my cells hear them very well. So I see two parts to this. Insulin, and I want you to discuss this. Obviously, insulin's connection with the cell, which we know inflammation and everything Americans do are driving that sensitivity to become less and less. And obviously, too many carbohydrates driving glucose and insulin, making it less and less to be able to hear the hormone. But also a liver issue. You know, the liver plays a big role in this liver problem, fatty liver. So discuss those two things, because people are going to say, okay, what are the strategies that I can get my cells hearing insulin and lower my insulin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key idea here, and the fatty liver actually and insulin resistance are very, very intimately tied, right? So the idea is that insulin sensitivity and insulin resistance is very important, because insulin is the major driver of obesity. But one of the things that causes the insulin to stay high all the time is insulin resistance. So if you have insulin resistance, then your body normally produces insulin to kind of overcome that resistance, right?
And for our viewers and listeners, you know, when we say this word resistance, folks, we're talking about the cell not being able to hear insulin well. The receptor to insulin is blunted, and there's multiple reasons, inflammation being one of them, but it can't hear the message. So therefore, you need more and more of the hormone, insulin in this case, to get the message in the cell. Okay, I didn't want to lose people on the resistance word.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. I actually have a different thought about what causes insulin resistance, but if you look at insulin resistance or resistance in general, you can look at, say, antibiotics and say what causes antibiotic resistance, right? And the body has a natural tendency to homeostasis, which is that it has a kind of comfortable state, and if you move out of it, it'll kind of move back to that comfortable state. So if you subject the body to kind of constant barrage of a hormone, any hormone, it will develop resistance. So if you, for instance, take a drug, you can use nicotine or you can use alcohol or marijuana or any of these drugs, you know, the first time you give it, it has a great effect, right? Whatever it is, you get very high or whatever it is. But if you continue to use it constantly, what happens is that effect goes down and down and down. And that's
Can I give my example there? Not to interrupt you, but I have to give the example. This is the example I always give, and Meredith's laughing because she knows what I'm going to say. I have five kids, Doc, so I always say it's like yelling at your children. When you first start yelling, it works. They go, oh, and they start listening, right? So, but then you notice that you're yelling, you find yourself yelling louder and louder. and they're listening less and less and less. By the time you're screaming at your kids all the time, and they don't even hear you anymore.
I said, yeah, that's right.
Of what's happening with hormones, right? More and more insulin. We're challenging insulin, insulin. At first, it works, but then it starts working less and less, and more insulin. That's the analogy I love to give.
I love that analogy, actually, because that's exactly what happens in the body, because if you give, and it's not just for insulin, but it's every hormone you can
every
think
hormone.
Of.
Everyone.
Even drugs, right? So if you keep giving it all the time, so it needs two things. It needs persistent levels and high levels, right? So if you're yelling with insulin, or whether you're yelling with cocaine or marijuana or whatever it is, your body eventually stops responding to it. And that's a natural protective mechanism, right? Because it's not used to these high levels, so it has to resist it. And if you take the example of antibiotic resistance, and this is a situation in a lot of hospitals where the antibiotics that we use are simply not effective anymore, right? And it's because, if you want to know why, it's because we use too many antibiotics, right? And that's the idea. So the natural response, though, is to use more antibiotics, right? Just like more yelling. But that's not the answer. That's actually the wrong answer, because you can see that, to use your example, the more you yell, the less response you get, right? Exactly. And it's a vicious cycle, because you yell more, they respond less. So you yell even more, and they respond even less. The actual answer is to use much less. And insulin is the same. So insulin resistance is actually caused by too much insulin.
Absolutely.
Not only too high, but persistently high. So as you use insulin all the time, then your body becomes less sensitive to it. As you become less sensitive to it or become more resistant, your body produces more insulin to overcome that resistance, right? But that's exactly the wrong response. You want to use less. So you either have to cut down the amount, the level, or the persistence of those levels. And that's what the intermittent fasting does. It provides you with that long period of very low insulin. So that means your body stays insulin sensitive.
That's
the key, because if insulin resistance is what's causing your high insulin level, it's not your diet anymore. And this is why people who have been obese for 20 years have a lot of trouble losing that weight, because it's a time-dependent phenomenon, right? And this is what people have to understand, that it's the insulin resistance that is keeping your insulin levels high. But the answer is not to give more insulin, just like in diabetes. The answer is not to give more. The answer is to give much, much, much less. And this is the thing. If you believe in calories, or even if you just believe in carbohydrates, if it's all carbohydrates or if it's all calories that drives obesity, then it should be the same whether you want to lose weight and you've been overweight for 15 years, or if you've been overweight for 15 days. You should be able to lose weight the same.
Absolutely.
Everybody knows it's not the same. The guy who's been overweight for 15 days drops it like that, right? The guy who's been overweight for 15 years has a hell of a time, because they've been going around that insulin resistance, insulin cycle, high insulin, insulin resistance cycle for so long that they need to get that fixed. And that's why the intermittent fasting is really such a powerful method, because it's not simply the diet. Now you're dealing with, so diet is a major factor in keeping insulin levels high, right? But it's the insulin resistance. And that's where we've gone off the track, right? If you go back to our dietary habits in the mid-70s, there were actually two major changes. So one, we went to a very low-fat diet, which was a mistake, right? Because that the fat has a lot of calories, so we said, well, you should cut your fat and all this kind of stuff. And everybody kind of knows about that already. But the second change that nobody ever talks about is that we went from an average of 3 meals a day, so breakfast, lunch, dinner. I grew up in the 70s. So you tried to have a snack, and your mom said, forget it, right? You're going to ruin your dinner.
Absolutely.
Right? But now we've gone in the mid-2000s to an average of 5 to 6 meals a day. So you look at your kids, and they're all breakfast, snack, lunch, snack, dinner, snack, right? And that's normal, right? And that's the average, right? So that's insane. So now we've actually set into motion the exact two things that we need for insulin resistance. We need high levels, in which we've done that with very high insulin foods like you know, refined grains, right? We've cut out the fat and ate more bread, right? That's the base of the food pyramid was the bread, right?
That's right.
And the second thing we did, which is what you need for resistance, is the persistence of those levels. So now people say you got to eat the minute you wake up, right? Breakfast is the most important meal of the day, right? And eat 5-6 times a day, constantly snack. So now you've got not only the high levels, but you've got the persistently high levels. Now you have set the stage for insulin to be high, insulin resistance to be high, and you're a sitting duck for obesity and type 2 diabetes, right? Oh. So the answer is to do what you do, which is give your body a break, right? So you think about it. The body is like, suppose you're in a dark room, right? And you go out in the sunlight and you're blinded, right? It's so bright. But after like 5 minutes, it's like normal, right? And that's the thing, that when you are in the dark and you suddenly get that bright light, it's got a huge effect on you. If you then go back in the dark, the next time the bright light comes in, it's going to have a huge effect. And that's what our body does. It keeps not just insulin, but all hormonal levels very low. So you can look at growth hormone, you can look at parathyroid hormone, melatonin. All the levels are practically undetectable. Then you get a burst.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And then they go back down to very low levels, right? That's the way our body is designed, because if you sit in the dark and you get that bright light, great effect. Go back to the dark. And then next time, bright light, you get great effect. But if you simply give that bright light all the time, it just loses all its effect. And that's what we've done. By keeping insulin, instead of insulin goes high and then low and then high and then low, we just keep it high all the time.
Right? Absolutely. That's a great analogy.
That's the problem.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, because the, you know, the 5-6 meals a day thing, you know, again, it's one of those things that people do it at first and they go, oh, that helped, right? They lose a little weight because their cells have zero hormonal ability to burn fat for energy. So when they eat more often, they're not burning as much muscle. They get a little spike in their metabolism a little bit and they go, oh, that kind of worked. Long term, you're dying sooner. I would say if you want to age faster than anybody, raise your glucose and insulin continually, right? I mean, that's what you do. Well, guess what? The best way to do that is eat 5-6 meals a day. That's you're just aging prematurely, of course.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing with the mammalian target of rapamycin and autophagy that we talked about, right? Because the biggest stimulant to autophagy, which is kind of this cellular kind of cleansing process, is not eating, right? It's actually the protein. The protein actually stimulates this kind of, stops us from kind of clearing out these kind of old damaged subcellular organisms, right? And so people knew. I mean, the funny part, I think, is that people have known this for thousands of years, because if you go back and look at all major religions, they all have periods of fasting, all of them.
Bingo.
Prolonged periods of fasting, 40 days and 40 nights, right? It's like crazy that they
look at the cultures that live the longest. You know, the tons of people and all these people, they say it's not even what they're eating to why they're living so long disease-free. It's the fact that they're not eating for so many times of the year, whether they run out of food, whether the seasons change. I mean, they, you know, in the Hunza period, they call it starvation spring. You know, it's like those fasting moments in the time people were eating, it was completely different then. They didn't have access to food all day. Food was precious. You know, they would go out hunting all day. And, you know, they wouldn't eat but maybe two meals a day. That's basically what we're emulating when we're intermittent fasting. We're emulating what cultures did, you know, for thousands and thousands of years and lived long doing it. So when we hear these studies of, you know, eating less calories and living longer, it really, Doc, should be eating less often in living. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, because nobody in history has decided to calorie restrict by eating small, frequent meals, right? The much easier thing to do is to cut out a bunch of meals. Like, why would you want to cook and clean and prep 6 times a day when you could do it once a day, right? Isn't it make a lot more sense, right, from a logistical standpoint? And the other thing that's crazy, and I see this all the time because we do a lot of fasting in our clinic as well, is that people come back and they say, you know, I didn't think it, I thought it'd be terrible, but it's actually really, really easy. And it's like, well, you know, because once you get into that mode of not eating, you know, there's no inertia there. The inertia is not to do it. It's kind of like my son, right? You can't get him into the bath. But when he's in the bath, you can't get him out of the bath, right?
I like that.
Same thing. When you start eating, it's just really hard to stop, right? So if you start by not eating, you might as well just ride that until it's time, right? And it's a lot easier.
I look, the last 2 days, you know, I always pick one day a week where I fast for 24 hours. I go dinner to dinner, right? The other days I'm typically doing between 18 and 20 hours. But the day before yesterday, I was so busy, I went on and on my day. I realized it had been 24 hours. I didn't eat. I didn't eat all day. Yesterday, the same thing. I went 2 days where I didn't eat for 24 hours. The day before and yesterday, I went 24 hours. And I wasn't hungry. I never thought about food. I had pure energy. My brain worked good. Oftentimes, when you eat, the blood rushes to your stomach. Your parasympathetic nervous system kicks in. And you get that sluggish down. It's like when I'm my busiest and I need my brain the most, I simply don't eat. Now, matter of fact, how many hours do you go? What's your intermittent fasting schedule?
I typically go 24 hours a couple times a week, although it really depends. It depends on how busy I am. When I get really busy, I really just do it a lot more because it saves me, like, you know, 45 minutes at lunchtime, right?
It's massive amount of time you have when you're not eating. My son didn't eat yesterday. He was like, Dad, he's like, I didn't realize how much eating bogs me down. I'm like, yeah, exactly, son.
Well, not just that, but people worry about not having energy and this whole, there's a whole thing that I won't be able to concentrate, right? And it is really funny that people think that, because it's like, it's pretty obvious that if you don't eat, your brain actually works better, right? Because if you think about it, you had a giant Thanksgiving dinner, right? Are you, like, really super sharp, or are you, like, sluggish on the couch watching television, right? Well, it's pretty clear that eating a lot doesn't really make you mentally very sharp, right? On the other hand, when you say that somebody is really hungry for something, right, they're hungry for power, hungry for this, hungry for that promotion, does it mean they're sluggish and have no energy? No. When you're hungry for something, it means you have a lot of energy and you're willing to do what it takes, right? And that's what the body does. It actually fuels you, and they've done so many studies on this fasting, it's actually, you know, it's been well established for like 50 years. Your noradrenaline levels go up, your growth hormone levels go up, and your metabolism doesn't go down, so you're actually more energetic. So at the beginning of the, and everybody worries about this metabolic slowdown that you see with the chronic, you know, calorie reduction, you don't see that with the fasting, because you know, you can fast for 4 days, and the resting metabolic rate at the end of the 4 days is actually 14% higher than it was at the beginning. So your metabolism is actually revving up. But what you've done is you've switched energy sources from food to fat, right? And that's all it's doing. That's all it's doing.
Yeah, I mean, so it is the opposite. So most days then, I mean, you're eating 1 to 2 meals a day, and you're going, you know, how long do you go in between? So you go...
I rarely eat breakfast. Like, I eat breakfast on the weekends now, but...
One day a week, I call it my feast, where I actually purposely eat more. Again, emulating our ancestors. So I purposely, on Saturdays, eat breakfast, you know, lunch and dinner. I try to eat more. By the way, it's hard for me.
I find the same. I mean, on the weekends, I find that I'm not actually hungry, but I do eat because my family is there, and I usually eat breakfast. You know, it's a you know, there are social things that go along with it, right? But because it's nice, right? For and this is what I say about fasting is you really have to find what fits into your life, because what fits into my life may not fit into somebody else's life. So on Saturdays and Sundays, right? It's a little less busy, so it's nice to enjoy that time in the morning and, you know, have a little bit of something with the kids and stuff, right, with my wife and the kids. And I like that. So I have something. I find that oftentimes I'm not hungry, but once I start, I can eat a full breakfast. Sure. Right? And that's what I mean, that sometimes it's just easier to go right through. Absolutely. So I do, but Monday to Friday, I almost never eat breakfast anymore. So then it's really easy, because then when you skip lunch, you've gone kind of 24 hours. So some weeks I wind up doing it like 4 out of the 5 days. And again, it's mostly because it depends on my work schedule, right? So when I get really busy, then I know that those are days that I'm going to, you know, it's not worth it for me, right? The body gets so used to it, it gets so easy to skip that meal that it's far more precious to me to get that 45 minutes or an hour and get home a little earlier. It's far more precious to me than eating something, yeah, right? It just doesn't matter that much, whereas that 45 minutes is hard to get back, right? And that's every day, right? Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, that's like 3-4 hours of extra time that I have to do stuff. So on days that it's not that busy, then I'll eat more, right? But it's, again, it depends a lot on social.
I think we're emulating feast and famine, and I think there's benefit to both. I believe the feast reminds our bodies that we have plenty and to burn fat. I think it makes us more of a fat-burning machine. You know, when the body says, hey, we're not starving here, it'll burn its fat with ease. The body, I believe, can create some blunting of the insulin receptor if it thinks it's starving, and that's not a good thing because it'll want to hold on. But I believe that one day or two of feasting is a really good thing in the fast. Here's what I would ask, though. I would ask that, what do you say to the people who go, I just can't go without food, right? I get dizzy. Because these are the, you know, we all, right, Meredith? We hear that all the time. Well, I get dizzy, but you and I know that eventually the body shifts. I call it the desert island experience. If I put you on a desert island, you'd have those days, but eventually you could go with one meal a day or no food and you would be just fine. So what do you say to that? I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, we warn people ahead of time that the first few times that they do this, it's going to feel really bad.
Absolutely.
And it's the same for ketosis, right? People talk about a keto flu and all this sort of stuff. And as you make that kind of shift in your metabolism, one, it takes a bit of time. But during that time, you have to understand that things are, it's not abnormal. And that's what. Because if they do it twice, and the first one was kind of bad, and the second one was kind of bad, then, like they're really hungry, they'd say, oh, I can't do this, like they give up. But it's like, look, you got to give your body a chance, right? If you want to learn to play the piano, you don't give up after two times, right? It's like, oh, I tried to play the piano twice, and, you know, I can't play this Beethoven piece. Well, you know, that's kind of ridiculous, right? It's the same thing. You have to let your body get used to it. So we warn them ahead of time, even before they start it. And sometimes, you know, most people do fine once they get started. Then they have to find their niche because it's funny because some people feel like great with the 24, 36 hours. And some people find that they do way better with like long fasts, like periodic 5 days, 7 days.
I agree with that. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I say, it doesn't matter to me. If you like this, then do it. If you like the other, do it, as long as you're getting your results. When people really have trouble, I actually have them sometimes, what I ask them to do, and not all of them do it, obviously, but I say, what you should do is go for a long period, like 5 or 7 days. Because that's going to force your body. It's kind of like the desert island, right? You're forcing your body to actually do it, right?
Absolutely.
And it takes a bit of motivation, and it takes a bit of people who are are willing to do it. But when they do that, their bodies usually make that adjustment because then they know, you kind of force your body to say, look, it's not coming, okay? There's no food coming. You better start shifting your metabolism. And then when it does, they find it much easier, right? And also if they're kind of in that kind of low carb, people who are eating a lot of, low carb or ketotic diets, they actually do much better, right? They find the fasting like really easy. Yeah. So it's kind of a natural kind of segue when they're already kind of in that high fat kind of diet. They actually do they switch over very well. So sometimes the other thing is to switch them to that diet first.
We take it in steps. That's what we do. We switch their diet oftentimes to what I call a cellular healing diet, to oftentimes a ketosis, more advanced cellular diet, and then we start the fasting. And you're exactly right. It's like these people that say, well, I have hypoglycemia, I can't do it. Oh, well, I have the cure, don't eat. What? That's the wrong, I can't not eat, right? It's like, no, just not eat. Day three, day four, magic happens every time. Eventually, yeah. The body goes, okay, I'm not going to die, so I'm going to switch my DNA, I'm going to turn genes off and turn some on, and all of a sudden, guess what? It starts utilizing fat for energy because it will not die. you know, it will do everything to survive, even burn fat. Imagine that. So, yeah, I mean, it is remarkable, that adaptation that occurs in everybody. You know, that's why you're right, some of those longer block fasts, you know, are what you need to eventually, every fast, they get more and more efficient at becoming fat burners.
Yeah, you know? And the switch is easier, so that even if they do feast, then they can very quickly go back and start burning fat again. And I tell them that that's what we want the body to do, right? Because fat is nothing more than stored food energy, right? But if you're constantly putting food in, it's not going to burn the fat because it has no reason to.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? The body does get more and more efficient with every restricted state, whether it's daily intermittent fasting or whether it's block fasting, more and more efficient. And I believe that when we fix that cellular energy problem, then we fix the majority of conditions that we're seeing today, even brain fog. You know, obviously the inability to lose weight, you know, whether it's thyroid, diabetes, all these hormonal problems, the cell becomes more, you know, sensitive to the hormones. You know, the cell becomes more efficient at utilizing fat, which burns cleaner than glucose. Everything starts to change. You know, Doc, we see it all the time, you know, and you know, we are just so privileged to have you, you know, on this show, and just the fact that, you know, seeing somebody doing what we do. You know, I call these things ancient healing strategies. You know, it's because, right, I mean, all we're doing is emulating really what our bodies are genetically set up to do.
You know, that's what I say too. Sometimes I call it the ancient secret, right, because it's been around forever, and it's a secret because everybody tells you not to do it, right? Yet it's exactly what you need to do, right? We tell people the opposite. Oh, eat all the time. And like, that's going to really work, right?
I have something that I call the 180-degree solution. And what it means is if you just watch the media, read all, you know, everything that everyone says about health, do the opposite, and somehow you hit it right every time. Oh, eat low fat? Try high fat. eat low calorie? You know, forget about low calorie. You know, eat till full. You know, I mean, basically every message that comes across is wrong. Fasting's dangerous. Fasting's bad. Well, actually, fasting's great. Eat a big breakfast. Don't eat breakfast at all. And we can just continue to go through. Eat 5-6 meals a day. Try eating one. You know,
That's what I said, too. I said I should call this the Costanza diet based on the Jerry Seinfeld episode where he did the opposite and he did, like, amazing.
I love that. You know what's funny is someone told me that, you know, about that episode where, you know, everything was opposite. I said, I got to play that at one of my seminars, you know, the Costanza thing. Yeah, everything's opposite. You know, we stand different, Doc, but we have a message that ultimately, could end an epidemic. You know, the healthcare crisis, it's not a better insurance or government-controlled program. It's what you and I are talking about. It's what we're doing in our, in our clinics and, you know, teaching doctors to do. This is it. This is the answer. And it stands 180 degrees opposite of everything people are hearing from their doctors, you know, from the media, from the government. And we just got to get more of us preaching this, you know, message, no doubt. So promote your book, The Obesity Code. I actually love the name, Doc, because The Obesity Code, I believe it is a genetic code, and we can change that code by the things that we're talking about, like intermittent fasting. Do you have a copy to hold up?
Oh, I don't have one here. I should have brought one.
Everyone will remember the name. Obesity Code. I'm sure you could buy it on Amazon, right?
Yeah, it's available everywhere now. So on Amazon, it's in the bookstores. So anywhere you go, you should be able to get it now.
Well, listen, we appreciate your work. We would love, I'm sure we'll have more requests to have you back on and continue some of these conversations. And, you know, Meredith, let me turn it over to you because, you know, Meredith, matter of fact, she just got done doing a 4-day water fast herself last week.
So wow, amazing.
Too. But Meredith, let me turn it back over to you.
Oh, thanks. And yeah, it was my first water fast. I had done some broth fasting and fasting on whey water, but I'd been a little intimidated by the water, but it was actually, I found it to be much easier than a lot of the other fasts that I had done. So I'm excited to do a longer water fast. And I do intermittent fasting daily. practice a lot of what you guys preach, of course. But just I had a lot of different questions, but just we're coming up on the end of the hour, so I know we don't have much time. But I'm just kind of curious, as a kidney expert, kind of what you have to say as far as fasting and electrolyte balance. I know that that's something that you know, people ask a lot about, and I took electrolytes, like kind of a concentrated electrolyte balance when I was doing my water fast. And just wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, for alternate daily fasting and shorter periods, so I kind of break it at around 24, 36 hours, I generally don't worry about it. Now, I measure it all the time in my, you know, in the lab for our patients, because people are worried about it, but it just about never is an issue. There is only one electrolyte that many people are deficient in, which is the magnesium, and that gives sometimes a lot of muscle cramps. Not very dangerous, but it gives a lot of muscle cramps, and people don't feel so well. So that is the one that many people are deficient in, but it's not really due to the fasting. They're just deficient in it anyway. So a lot of type 2 diabetics are deficient in it, so we do have some strategies for magnesium replacement, but that's the only one that I actually find quite a bit of, but I find it before we even do the fasting. So the fasting doesn't really make it any worse. It certainly doesn't help. So I just about never have a problem. Now, you have to be a little bit more careful if people have kind of advanced heart disease or advanced kidney disease. So I don't use it for advanced kidney disease, just because there is a little bit more problems with it. Yeah, I don't really worry about the electrolytes. I measure them just to make sure that people are staying hydrated and all this kind of stuff, measure their kidney function, make sure they're doing okay. But other than that, I don't worry about it. For a long period fast, like a week or more, then I'll have people take a general multivitamin, and that's about it.
Yeah, then it's enough to replace the lead. We just have people take some sea salt, simple as that.
Yeah.
You know, which maintains, you know, helps maintain the electrolytes. So, but yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, great question.
Thanks, Dr. Fung, and so appreciate having you on today. Just to kind of finish up, wondered if you had, you know, two or three takeaways for our audience if they wanted to start to kind of implement some of these strategies.
Yeah, I think the main takeaways in terms of weight loss is, one, you know, first of all, understand that this is a hormonal imbalance and not a caloric imbalance. So if you understand that, then you know how to fix it, right? So if the problem is too high in insulin, well, your strategy is, how am I going to lower it? So one, you don't want to eat foods that really stimulate insulin. So that's mainly the sugar and the refined grains. So bread and pasta and all those things that used to be on the bottom of that food pyramid. So that's one thing. That's the what to eat question. And the second question is really when to eat. And again, if you understand that insulin depends on both the high levels but the persistence of those levels, then you want to have long periods of time where your levels are low. So you want to do some intermittent fasting. And that doesn't have to be long. Like, you could do 18 hours a day. Lots of people do that. Mm-hmm. Or even, or you know, longer 24-hour periods, maybe twice a week is another popular strategy. Or you could just do long periods, like 7 days once in a while, right? That will work just as well. And these cleanses, like Beyonce does, the Master Cleanse, which is, you know, you have a little bit of funny stuff with lemon juice and so on, but essentially it's a fast. You could do that too. But whatever it is that you want to do, you want to break that kind of insulin resistance, because that is like one of the key kind of problems that you can't just deal with in terms of the what to eat question, right? There's always two questions, what to eat and when to eat, and we have to hit both of those questions in order to be successful. And I think that's why a lot of diets kind of fail, because they only talk about what to eat, right? And we're mostly in agreement. Like, nobody says you should eat white bread anymore, right? Even the low-calorie people or low-fat people, nobody says, oh yeah, go eat a lot of white bread, right? Nobody says that anymore, right? So we're more or less in agreement on what to eat. It's the when to eat question that, you know, we've really got wrong. The 6-7 times a day, it's all wrong, right? We have to really get people thinking about that more and saying, well, if you understand that it's about too much insulin, now, you know, figure out what to eat, figure out when to eat, and implement the strategy that works best for you and that fits into your life, right? Because it's not going to be the same for everybody. And some people say, oh, you know, I do this and that. I do 18-6, right, every day. And they say, is that okay? I'm like, well, are you losing weight? You know, yeah, I'm losing weight steadily, and then it's great, right? It's like, there's nothing wrong with it. Now, if you start to plateau, then you've got to change it up, right? Other people won't do so well on that strategy, and I'll change it up, right? Huh. So again, you have to find what works for you in your life, because again, it's the fasting. If you're eating dinner, if you like to eat dinner with your family, and then you start doing these 3-day fasts or 5-day fasts, and it's disrupting your family life. I had one guy who used to not go to a social event, like he used to get together with his buddies for lunch every day, and he'd not do that because he's like, that's not the idea, right? The idea is to fit it around,
that's
right?
It.
So you have to fit it in. Don't cut yourself off because you're doing the fasting, right? It's part of your life, right? Fit it in because there's lots of opportunity to do so. That's the key. That's the key to doing it. And find what works for you. Find the strategy that works for you. There are general guidelines that I lay out, but I don't use prescriptions so much because, you know, everybody's so different, right?
It's great. Bravo. Thank you, Doc. We really appreciate it. What a great alignment we have with you and your message and ours. So awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fung. Thanks, everyone, for watching. It was an awesome episode, jam-packed with information. And Dr. Fung, we'll have to keep in touch and maybe have you back on the show in the future.
All right. Thank you.
And Check out his book, The Obesity Code. It's out now. It's March 2016. So check it out. And his website is Intensive Dietary Management. All right, everyone. We'll catch you next time.
The information shared on today's show can be accessed through our websites, drpompa.com and revelationhealth.com. This Cellular Healing TV episode and past shows are also available for download on iTunes. Help others get real health solutions by liking, reviewing, and sharing our podcasts.